Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International.
Things in the world now appear smaller, more toy-like. An object that once towered above us, a tall pine, a steep hill, a snow-capped mountain, is itself dwarfed by the dome, which, by the ever-present fact of its vastness, miniaturizes what it encloses. The Mississippi is nothing but a trickle of water in a child's terrarium. The Rockies are only a row of stones in a third-grade diorama. Events themselves, under such conditions, have receded in importance, have become aestheticized.
You're listening to Alec Baldwin reading from Stephen Milhauser's fantasy, The Dome. You'll be hearing the complete story later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. The story that you're about to hear me read, Stump Louie, by Lisa Halliday, published in the Paris Review, takes place before America's entry into World War II, and it is filled with the atmosphere of small-town live radio broadcasts and popular music of that early 1940s era. It's a remarkable story, and it was introduced on stage by the senior editor of the Paris Review, Nathaniel Rich, author of the novel The Mayor's Tongue.
Publishing debut fiction is really crucial to what we do at the Paris Review. And over the transom one day came a story by a writer who had never published a story before, and we were thrilled and amazed to find that it was a beautiful story, funny, tragic, epic in scope, and for me is really about the end of childhood, growing up, and good old-fashioned American exploitation. And I'm very pleased to present Isaiah to read Lisa Halliday's Stump Louie.
Tomislav Stern's father sent him to America with the advice that every human relationship, from employment to love, survives on exploitation. Stern, now Tommy Sternlight, had been in vaudeville since arriving in New York in 1904, when, thanks to a string of shrewd social maneuvers, he landed a job in Albany, sweeping up after performances at the Strand. Monday nights, when the theater was closed, he would usher young nobodies through a back door and audition them under the pretext that he was a professional talent scout with some legitimate sway. His father's advice proved indispensable to recognizing among the hopefuls with talent those willing to work for peanuts. Children with inattentive parents or no parents at all required little compensation beyond the huge warmth of Sternlight's hand on their shoulder or his face beaming in their direction with munificence and pride. His first spectacular discovery, twin six-year-old blonde girls who tap danced as though they were on fire, won him some modest box office percentages, and within a year, having delivered three equally sensational acts, Sternlight had his reputation as upstate New York's premier eagle eye for cheap talent. 37 years later, his career had stalled. Attendance was dwindling at the dance studio where he cultivated his young talent, and his last big hit, Rosemary Pizzula, who roller skated to classical music, had long outgrown the act and moved to Boston to marry an electrical engineer. Even if retirement were affordable, Sternlight knew too many aging impresarios who'd gone that route and prematurely taken a slide, become full-time lamenters on half-baked issues, barflies as self-righteously incensed as they were inert. Already, it was too easy to pull a stool up alongside them, too easy to bemoan the decline of live musical entertainment in this country, Too easy to shrug and reach for a handful of pistachios when asked what he intended to do about it. He had nothing to show for these evenings of intemperance but a splitting headache and the lingering nausea of remorse. Then, the dance studio's longtime accompanist had a stroke. She survived, but could no longer steady her hands to play, and she implored Sternlight to give her son the job instead. He had just graduated from high school, she said, and played the piano beautifully. Sternlight took this for maternal hyperbole, but it turned out to be true. Little Luigi Palmieri played even the tuneless warm-up vamp as though it were Rhapsody in Blue and he were giving a concert for Gershwin. Furthermore, unlike his predecessor, he didn't need a metronome to keep time. The only problem was that he had a distracting habit. Whenever he wasn't playing, he closed his eyes and wiggled his hands in the air above the keyboard as though only this could sustain his readiness to resume. One would think, Sternlight gently teased Luigi at the end of his first week, that piano would be hypnotized by now. Luigi's reply was to lower his hands to the keyboard, where, still wiggling, they looked like two toy helicopters touching down, and to play. You've got me hypnotized. I'm certainly mesmerized. I thought I was wise till I gazed in your beautiful eyes. Touché, said Sternlight over the music. The following afternoon, during intermediate tap, one of the girls asked Luigi if he knew the Flatfoot Flugy. He did. After class, while they changed their shoes, slumming on Park Avenue, leaning on a lamppost, when the swallows come back to Capistrano, a few bars of each of these, Luigi played easily. Hot lips, said Sternlight. The girls giggled. Luigi played. Minnie the Moocher, the girls screamed. Luigi played. I'm a jazz vampire. Surabaya Johnny, Dardanella. I can't dance. I got ants in my pants. Luigi knew them all. And the inexhaustible thrill of testing his jukebox genius began to detain Sternlight and his clientele, mesmerized well beyond the end of lessons each day. When the girls told their friends at school that Sternlight's dance studio had hired a human pianola, matriculation went up 30%, and Sternlight raised Luigi's salary from 30 cents an hour to 45. As he tried to thank Sternlight for this boon, Luigi was betrayed by a terrible stutter. Sternlight knew from the kid's mother that years of humiliation owing to this handicap had conditioned Luigi to go out of his way to avoid all unnecessary social interaction. But Stump Louie, as Sternlight had begun to call the game, was different. Luigi's infinite repertoire had transformed him into a boy Orpheus. No minefield of consonants to worry about. He didn't have to speak. Even his appearance had begun to change. He straightened up at the piano, smiled more, and his eyes glinted bright green as though lit by tiny bulbs within. After the Yankees beat the Dodgers in the 1941 World Series and radio listeners statewide began to suffer from baseball withdrawal, Sternlight rang up a friend of a friend, the head of commercial broadcasting for radio station WABY, to propose something so audacious and harebrained that the men agreed it was irresistible. Name a song, Albany. Name a song. Pick your key, sing five words for us, and little Louis Palmer here will play the rest. Not a page of sheet music in sight, folks. Nothing in the studio but Louis and a shiny new Marshall and Wendell baby grand. So come on, Albany. Tell Tommy what you want to hear. If Louis can't play it, we'll pack up and go home. You've got 30 minutes to pick up the phone and stump Louis. The prize for stumping Louis, for naming a song Luigi couldn't play at least five bars of by heart, was an all-expenses-paid weekend trip for two to Niagara Falls. For over a minute, Sternlight, Luigi, a volunteer production crew, and a provisional studio audience of station janitors waited in silence. Someone coughed. Luigi sat wiggling on the bench of a battered old upright full of chipped keys. Finally, one of the two telephones on a podium next to Sternlight rang. and through some trick of wiring, an elderly female voice was audible both on the soundstage and over the air. "Hello, Tommy. Blue Hawaii, please. It was my husband's favorite." Sternlight smiled and rolled his eyes while Louis pressed a finger to one key, then another, waited for the volume to fade out before proceeding with the next, and at last allowed the whole song to unfurl. The lady on the line sniffed and laughed, blew her nose, and hummed along precariously at the chorus. She was still praising Luigi for his fluency when the second phone rang, and a man asked to hear Carolina Moon. Luigi played, and the caller sang along in a vibrato-laden bass. Two more listeners called up in quick succession, and though they both named songs written at least 10 years before Luigi was born, he played through each of them efficiently as though he had somewhere to be or soup cooling in the green room, and then sat back to wait, wiggling, for the next test. "One more," mouthed Sternlight, tapping his watch. And while the last caller prefaced his request with a story about having heard "I Say It's Spinach" for the first time on a date with a girl with a lisp, Sternlight's eyes widened, imploring Luigi for some clue that spinach rang a bell. Luigi nodded. Hurriedly, Sternlight fished a pen out of his jacket pocket and wrote something on his palm, W-A-I-T, wait. Squinting, bewildered, Luigi obeyed, wiggling his fingers soundlessly above the gap-toothed keyboard while Sternlight let their inaugural audience hold its breath. At last, Sternlight cued Luigi with a grand victorious flourish, and the boy sailed through "I Say It's Spinach" as though it were happy birthday and he were playing it on the kazoo. They did the show again the following Sunday. And to the amazement of everyone except Sternlight, whose enterprising mind had already shut out the possibility that his star's musical omniscience was anything but absolute, Luigi again survived the half hour unstumped. A third and fourth show followed, each half an hour long, and ending on the same score, Louis Palmer 5, Radioland zilch. They moved the show to the stage of the Strand and sold tickets to a live audience. Marshall and Wendell doubled its investment and donated an actual baby grand. A consulting team of WABY producers suggested that to add a little variety to the program, Louis be allowed to ask up to 3 questions, such as who composed the song, who originally recorded the song, and whether the song was written for a film or a Broadway show. Luigi was encouraged to ask the questions even if he already knew the answers. He never did. He didn't need clues, and he wasn't about to risk stuttering on the air for the sake of a little dramatic effect. So there was just a brief, suspenseful moment of static after each request while Louis Palmer consulted the limitless songbook that was his brain. Once, there was a pause of several worrisome seconds before anything happened, but as it turned out, Luigi was just expecting a sneeze. A spate of them came and went, and using the last sneeze as his downbeat, Luigi rolled out Sleepy Lagoon. Like many, it was a request made less in the interest of stumping Louis than in the indulgence of the caller's mood, in this case, the memory of a wife who had just died. As Luigi obliged, playing the old chestnuts softly, the widower on the other end of the line began to cry. When the song was over, the second phone rang and rang, but Sternlight let the man's sobs rack the airwaves for another minute and a half. Ratings soared, and the station collected a small fortune in advertising revenue. Based on the number of calls it received during episode 4, WABY estimated that Stump Louie's listenership had quadrupled. The public's conviction, ridiculous but predictable, that anyone equipped with a Marshall and Wendell might play the piano as well as Louis Palmer, inundated the manufacturer with more orders than it was able to fill. 6 flush corporations began to bid for sponsorship. Leading purveyors of linens, insurance, canned food, refrigerators, light fixtures, and real estate, companies already established outside the Tri-City area and looking to expand. But wary of a dead-in-the-water investment, they insisted that before talking numbers, they see something in writing from the kid. "They want him to sign a contract?" Sternlight asked incredulously. The head of corporate sponsorship held up his hands. He's a kid, for Christ's sake, said Sternlight. He wants to make us happy. He wants to be revered. And even if he does have it in him to swindle us, what good's a piece of paper going to do? What'll it say? That if he knows the song, he has to play it? How's anyone going to know whether he knows a song or not? Look, if we offer him $10 a show, he'll be making 50 times what I used to pay him. You think a kid who's never seen the other side of Mechanicville is going to throw that away? No, the head of corporate sponsorship said he didn't. But neither did he think it would be long before Luigi would wise up to the value of his indispensability and refuse to play without a percentage share. The studio stood to gross over $1,000 per show. Sternlight's commission was 20%. If the Marshall and Wendell boom was any indication, the sponsors would double their quarterly returns with one spot. But without a contract, Luigi held all the cards. And the sponsors had made it clear that if he decided to play them, they would be willing to renegotiate. Never mind the slipperiness of his talent, luck, divinity, whatever the magic and whether it would run out, this was a contingency. Stump Louie's potential sponsors were ready to accept it, but only at a fixed rate, and with some serious assurance that the magician was willing to perform. Sternlight arrived the next morning at the station with a wan-looking Luigi in tow. No one in the conference room had ever seen Louis Palmer anywhere other than on the stage of the Strand. And here, under harsher light, following Sternlight with his eyes on the taller man's heels, he looked frail and vulnerable. He stood next to Sternlight at the end of a long table lined with executives. Waiting for him there was a piece of paper, a pen, a pitcher of water, and a glass. Sternlight looked thoughtfully at these for a moment and then reached around Luigi to put a hand on the boy's shoulder. He inspected the fingernails of his other hand as he spoke. Louis, Sternlight said, son, Luigi's eyes widened at this word. How old are you? Luigi stared at the water. 17? Luigi shook his head. 18? Luigi nodded. And how long have you been playing the piano? Luigi said nothing. All your life, right? Luigi shrugged. And has anyone ever asked you to play a song you didn't know? Luigi shook his head. No, that was true. Well, that's a pretty special gift you got there, isn't it, Lou? Luigi nodded. And you take that gift of yours pretty seriously, don't you, Lou? Yes, Luigi nodded. He did. And consequently, you make a lot of people happy. You know that? You take their minds off their problems. Not a small thing in this world, Lou. Not a small thing. In fact, it's pretty special. Luigi nodded again, flushing, as Sternlight repeated himself. Pretty special, Lou. Pretty damn special. He gave Luigi's shoulder an encouraging shake and squeeze. Luigi was nodding incessantly now. And even if you do get stumped, Sternlight added, releasing Luigi to pour himself a glass of water, even if it happens this afternoon. Well, that's okay, Lou, that's okay. Nobody's perfect. We know you did the best you could. The heavyweights caved, and Louis's listeners multiplied week after week. No one wanted to miss the historic moment when somebody would stump the seemingly unstumpable Louis Palmer. Sunday afternoons from 2:30 to 3, the streets of Luigi's hometown were evacuated but for a few whirling leaves. Those who didn't own a radio gathered in friends' houses, beauty parlors, barbershops, and bars. During episode 5, when it was announced that Louis would have a weekly hour-long slot, the nuns at St. Anthony's in Troy pawned an effigy and purchased a radio for the rectory. During episode 7, when it was announced that Louis would be playing on Wednesdays and Saturdays as well, the pleasure in the prolonged anticipation of Louis Palmer's dethronement took a perverse turn. Was there any song Louis Palmer didn't know? How long could this go on? An interview published in the Times Union quoted Sternlight inviting skeptics to see for themselves that the show was not rigged. Maybe the kid is a Martian, but I'm no Orson Welles. What you hear every week is done in front of a live audience, and if anybody out there needs to see it with his own eyes, well, be my guest. And don't ask, because I haven't the faintest idea how he does it. I don't think he knows himself. When Luigi was 6, so that he might aspire to become a composer, his father undertook to teach him the fundamentals of piano playing, keys, scales, chords, chord progressions, and the rules, rhythm and tonality. Because, his father explained, like Michelangelo, invoked by a postcard of the Medici chapel clothespin to the music scroll of the piano, devi conoscere perfettamente le regole. Only when you know the rules backwards and forwards should you proceed to break them. Learning the rules backwards and forwards meant playing nothing but scales and chord progressions, up and down and up and down the keyboard for 3 hours every afternoon after school, plus 6 hours on Saturday, so that Luigi's hands became so nimble and automatic that the right sharps and flats would pull on his fingers like magnets. Partly because his father had a fatal heart attack before he could explain how much longer the strict diet of fundamentals was to go on, and partly because the mindless activity went some way towards anesthetizing Luigi's ensuing grief, Luigi played nothing but scales and chord progressions for another 4.5 years. His mother finally retaliated by replacing the piano with a radio that would always be on. And it wasn't long before Luigi realized that he had only to hear a song once, and he was programmed to play it. The boundaries of this magic, as it was perceived by Louis Palmer's fans, were what made being Louis Palmer for Luigi Palmieri unbearable. He didn't know Tchaikovsky's number one in B-flat minor. He didn't know any of the forgotten songs by Debussy. He could play the third movement of Liszt's B minor sonata, but only below tempo, and certainly not without looking at the music. And then there was Beethoven's Great Emperor, of which he'd never played a note. An anonymous fan letter surmised that making love to Louis Palmer must be like making love to all the music in the world. These last six words at once suggested such a gross exaggeration of Luigi's actual capacity and the perfect articulation of what he aspired to be, looped day-long in his head. On the bus home, while he changed his clothes, washed his face, lay in bed, over and over, they played like a record skipping. All the music in the world. The supposed stuff of his supremacy, it was an ungraspable idea. The whim of some daydreamer contending with her sexual longing on heavily perfumed stationery, but his unworthiness of the concept tormented him all the same. Occasionally, there would be a bullying call from someone with whom Luigi had gone to school. Hey, Louis Palmer, it's Joey Scaramuzzo, remember me? Luigi's new name was repeated wondrously, as though its very pronunciation awoke fond memories of camaraderie in the schoolyard. How's about Paris makes me horny? And in the background, a gang of hangers-on tittered. These moments so unnerved Luigi for their bitter whiff of the old antipathy that a couple of times he let loose a note before the song had even been named. Head down, fingers wiggling, he held his breath until the actual order came through, then launched the song off that premature stroke, even if it meant playing the whole thing in some outrageous key. And yet, the fundamental appeal of Stump Louis was not the irresistibility of trying to depose its star. It was the idea that a human among us, a kid no less, could sit down at a piano and play whatever we want to hear. So not even Louis Palmer's fiercest antagonists were trying all that hard to think outside the limited soundtracks of their nostalgia. No one was home ransacking his record collection to find the winning obscurity. Sternlight's ingenious rule, which he repeated at the start of each show, was that the second someone stumps Louis Palmer, Stump Louis goes off the air. No one, not even Joey Scaramuzzo, really wanted that to happen. Of course, it occurred to Luigi to pull the plug by pretending to be stumped. He'd even practiced in front of a mirror. You got me, he would say the next time someone asked to hear something plausibly obscure. I'm stumped. But only once, after three shots of his late father's grappa, was he able to get through all five words without the g or the st tripping him up, and still he imagined that no non-lethal amount of alcohol would alleviate the anxiety of trying to put one over on all of Greater Albany on the air. And then there was his psychological contract with Sternlight, whose surrogate paternity he wasn't quite ready to give up. And the phantom lovers, better than no lovers at all, whose desire to make love to him was conditioned on his knowing every song in the world. And the likelihood that his life would go back to normal soon enough. At his most introspective, he was even able to admit that of all the reasons to be Louis Palmer, the biggest was something new to him, pride. On the first Sunday in December, someone called up and asked to hear a song Luigi didn't know. Maybe she was pulling his leg and had asked to hear a song that didn't exist. It doesn't matter. It was the last request of the day, and Sternlight had already held up his palm, ordering Luigi to wait. So for half a minute or more, everyone remained oblivious to the catastrophe. Only Luigi knew. Luigi, and perhaps the piano with its gleaming, enormous silence. What he'd imagined would be his liberation loomed monstrously now, as empty futures do. Dramatized by Sternlight into something like evangelism, Stump Louis had converted even its star into a sucker for all the illusion. And yet, it was a fantasy that would, after all, endure. Because before Sternlight could cue Luigi to play, the show was interrupted by an announcement of what had happened that morning in Hawaii. The crashing mood in the theater, the stupefaction and clamor for more information buried the song request. In deference to war coverage, Stump Louis was suspended, first temporarily, then permanently, when its sponsors declared ball games the more reliable investment. 5 years later, Sternlight was still alive to produce and preside as master of ceremonies over one of the world's first serially televised variety shows. Broadcast live from Schenectady on Friday nights, just before the weekly boxing fights on WRGB, each episode began with a riff between Sternlight, who'd taken up ventriloquism, and a querulous doll named Bernard. Chesterfield and Lucky Strike rivaled each other for prime sponsorship spots. Water-cooled lights dripped onto the stage. The cast included several of Sternlight's former stage protégés, but it was an unknown named Eleanor DeLuke who debuted at the piano. Louis Palmer had been drafted into the Navy in 1942, and somewhere off the Solomon Islands the following year, he was killed. Thank you. Lisa Halliday's story, Stump Louis, read by your host, Isaiah Sheffer. We'll be back in a minute with Alec Baldwin reading an amazing work of the imagination. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Selected Shorts is sponsored by ZabarsCoffee.com, featuring hand-selected and custom-roasted Zabar's coffee, shipped daily to coffee drinkers across America who want a great cup of coffee at a reasonable price. Available at ZabarsCoffee.com. ZabarsCoffee.com. Our friend, the Broadway film and television actor Alec Baldwin, loves to read short stories for selected shorts audiences, and he has done so in New York and Los Angeles and other places in between. It's usually a matter of finding a story to match Alec's busy schedule, alternating between the East and West Coasts. We were fortunate that he could be in New York on the night of our program of stories from the Pushcart Prize, because his assigned story, Stephen Milhauser's The Dome, was a perfect match for Alec's dry humor and sharp narrative style. The Dome is read for us now by Alec Baldwin.
The first domes, the precursors, appeared here and there in affluent neighborhoods on out-of-the-way roads where they attracted a certain attention before growing familiar and nearly invisible. The few outsiders who actually witnessed them tended to dismiss them as follies of the rich, comparable to underground heating pipes for winter gardens or basement bowling alleys with automatic pin setters. Even the early newspaper reports did not quite know what tone to take, shifting uneasily from technical description to ironic commentary with moments of guarded praise, and that was hardly surprising, since the domes, while having features that were judged to be admirable, displayed themselves in a way that could readily strike an unsympathetic observer as pretentious or irritating. Each of the early models, made of transparent viviglass, was designed to fit directly over a house and its property. Now emerging from the front or back door in summer, the owner of a dome could step comfortably into a world of air-conditioned lawns and gardens. Thanks to a highly efficient system of filters and evaporator coils built into the viviglass. There were other advantages. Recessed fluorescent lighting with dimmer switches permitted the property to be illuminated at night so that you could read a book or newspaper in the cool outdoors on the hottest, muggiest evenings. Owners were encouraged to practice their golf swings, play badminton after dark, and enjoy a bit of night gardening in the always perfect weather under the dome. In fact, it was a boast of the manufacturer, much quoted at the time, that, quote, inside our dome, rain never falls, unquote. As if that wasn't enough, the manufacturer promised future models that would heat the enclosures in winter, though a number of difficulties still needed to be ironed out. It was, above all, as technical achievements that the early domes impressed most observers, who nevertheless remained skeptical. Questions were raised about the extent to which such excesses were likely to be shared by the average American household, since the domes at that time cost nearly as much as the estates they encapsulated. Nor could a number of journalists resist reflecting on the metaphorical implications of those glistening, crystalline structures which enclosed the rich in little princedoms that insulated them even further from the everyday world. There were, moreover, serious flaws in the early domes, which became apparent soon enough. Grackles, jays, and sparrows settled in great numbers on the dome tops, where they blocked the sky and left broad smears of yellowish-white excrement. To make matters worse, many birds, deceived by the transparent viviglass, flew directly into the thick walls and fell dead or injured to the ground below. Now the manufacturer had to send out daily cleaning crews who washed the outsides of the domes, gathered up the dead and injured birds, and installed small boxes that made a grinding noise intended to discourage wasps, bees, birds, and Japanese beetles from settling anywhere on the shiny surfaces. Other problems began to reveal themselves. Rainwater, as it evaporated, left dusty streaks which had to be removed. Airborne particles gradually formed a layer of grime. Trouble developed even on the insides of the domes, where mist from sprinkler systems collected on the inner surfaces, increasing the humidity and obscuring the view. The manufacturer devoted itself assiduously to every complaint, while pointing out in its own defense that many of the little annoyances were due strictly to summer and might be expected to vanish with the season. The owners waited, and as the weather turned cold, frost formed colossal and oppressive patterns on the transparent surfaces, which were further darkened by the falling of the first snow. One might have been forgiven at this point for predicting the death of the domes. In many instances, the owners did, in fact, have them removed, a costly business requiring a small army of workmen and fleets of flatbed trucks. Others remained steadfast through the winter, during which a number of benefits became evident. No snow fell on the walks and driveways, bushes and hedges were protected from harmful layers of ice. The air inside the domes, though still unheated, grew pleasantly warm on cold but sunny afternoons. Such discoveries were offset by a burst of new drawbacks. Accumulations of thick-crusted snow froze to the tops of the domes, while spears of ice clung to the sides, and sweeps of high-drifted snow pressed up against the viviglass doors. By the end of the first winter, it was clear to most customers that the domes were more trouble than they were worth. The change came in early spring. Three separate events took place within one crucial 10-day period. The manufacturer discovered a cheaper and stronger substance, Splendamax. They reduced the cost of the domes by half. A pollution alert lasting an entire week drew new attention to the domes as pure environments. And a rash of kidnappings in small towns in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont led to a sudden interest in the domes as protective shells. Now the domes began to appear in less exclusive neighborhoods, where crowds gathered to watch enormous strips of Splendamax being lowered into place by towering cranes. Newspapers and weekly magazines paid close attention to the new middle-class phenomenon, which some journalists attributed to the influence of the mall, with its habit of combining disparate elements under a single roof. Others saw in the trend still another instance of a disturbing tendency in the American suburb, the longing for withdrawal, for self-enclosure, for expensive isolation. As the domes began to spread slowly, rival manufacturers produced less costly varieties, composed of improved materials and marketed under an array of names: Vitrolon, Excelliplex, Anthoperm, Colossotherm, often with new and attractive features. One dome was equipped with a heating system for winter, another had retractable panels for controlling frost and mist, and one well-advertised version, promoted by educators, came with an artificial night sky that displayed constellations, planets, and other heavenly bodies, scientifically adjusted to latitude and longitude, which moved slowly across the inner surface and were far more vivid and convincing than those in the actual sky. Yet this activity, too, might have run its course, leaving behind a scattering of domed properties in towns that had gone on to new diversions, had it not been for an event that took many observers by surprise. Just when it seemed that the market for domed houses had reached its limit, a developer decided to enclose several blocks of newly constructed homes on 14 acres of land beneath a single dome. The vast span of Splendamax rose not only over individual properties, but over a small park with swings, a communal swimming pool, a stretch of oak and beech trees, and nine freshly paved streets. 2 weeks later, in a nearby town, a gated community voted to endome itself. And as the fashion for doming continued to spread, citizens at town meetings and city halls began to debate the question of enclosing commercial districts and public lands while keeping them accessible to area residents. It was during this phase of enlarged domings that the first town voted to enclose itself in a massive dome that was reputed to be one of the great engineering feats of the new millennium. The immensity of the structure, the sheer drama and bravado of it all, caused a sharp increase of interest, for the new magnitude represented a decision could no longer be dismissed as a passing trend. Critics attacked the hostile apartness of the town, which in its hemisphere of veridiglow was said to resemble a walled medieval city, as if the advance in technology served only to conceal a secret atavism. Admirers, as might be expected, hailed the brilliance of the engineering, the grandeur of technological accomplishment, which placed the new dome in the noble line of the skyscraper, the suspension bridge, the hydroelectric dam, and the ancient pyramid. Others praised the domed town for its clean air, a system of escape vents permitted the expulsion of factory pollutants and gasoline fumes, while several took a more aesthetic approach, finding in the space enclosed by the dome a spirit of gaiety, of pleasurable artifice, reminiscent of the old European plaza with its fountain and shade trees, or the American Mall with its food court and Santa's workshop. For under the roof of the dome, the inhabitants of the town were said to feel a bond of community, a sense of uninterrupted gathering in a special place set aside for their common pleasure. To the surprise of almost everyone, the new dome did not immediately spawn another. It was as if people felt that the doming process was moving ahead a little too rapidly and required a pause, during which the consequences of the new technology might be studied more carefully. It was recognized, to begin with, that the sheer cost of a dome this size far exceeded the annual budget of all but the wealthiest towns. At the same time, a broad range of practical problems had yet to be solved, such as the efficient flow of traffic into and out of the dome, the pattern and duration of nocturnal illumination, and the seasonal migration of birds living within the structure. People began to wonder whether they would be safe under a dome or whether a permanent enclosure might prove harmful in the long run. But even as the issue hung in the balance, decisions were being made in remote rooms, behind closed doors, that would soon change everything. We live in the aftermath of those decisions. To say that the dome is the single largest achievement in the history of architecture is inadequate and misleading. It is a leap beyond into some new domain without a name. The story of its building is well known. The drama of starting on both coasts. The erection of the great pillars. The early collapse of the Northwest Foundation. The construction of the offshore airports, the closing of the final gap. Many of us can scarcely remember a time when we did not live beneath a soaring roof of transparent Celestilux. And yet the achievement is not without its detractors, even today. Critics argue that the dome represents the complete triumph of consumer society, of which it is the extravagant and unapologetic symbol. For the dome, they say, has transformed the entire country into a gigantic mall whose sole purpose is to encourage feverish consumption. The sensation of being under a common roof, of living continually under artificial lights, is said to stimulate in the average citizen a relentless desire to buy. And it remains true that the completion of the dome has been accompanied by a sharp increase in consumer spending, as if everything beneath the Celestilux roof, houses, lakes, clouds, were being displayed to advantage and offered ceaselessly for sale. Some have even claimed that our dome is the final flowering of the 19th century department store, of which the American Mall was only a transitional horizontal form. According to this view, the great empty spaces of the dome will gradually be put to commercial use. There are predictions of transparent floors in the sky. Level upon level, connected by hollow Celestilux tubes containing motorized passenger platforms. But those who dislike the dome do not simply accuse it of serving the interests of late capitalism. They attack the name itself, arguing that the enclosure follows the irregular shape of the continental United States and is therefore no true dome. Defenders, while not denying that the lower base is irregular, are quick to remind their opponents that at a height of 400 feet, the soaring walls of Celestilux slope inward and gradually provide the base for a classic dome that rises over most of the nation. Indeed, the forging of a true dome above a vast irregular perimeter is one of the engineering triumphs of the entire project. But defenders are not confined to such quibbles. They point proudly to a host of benefits: the national regulation of climate, the protection of our coasts against hurricanes, the creation of 24-hour illumination, and the consequent elimination of time zones, the Celestilux shield against ultraviolet radiation. Without choosing sides in the debate, we may note a number of subtler changes. Because everything lies beneath a single dome, because everything is, in a very real sense, indoors, our feelings about nature are no longer the same. The dome, in a single stroke, has abolished nature. The hills, the streams, the woods, the fields, all have become elements in a new decor, an artfully designed landscape, designed by the mere fact of existing under the dome. This experience of landscape as style has been called the new interiority. In former days, a distinction was made between inside and outside. People emerged from their homes or apartments and arrived outside today. One leaves one's dwelling place and steps into another, larger room. Change is dramatic. The world perceived as an interior shimmers with artifice. A tree growing in a park is indistinguishable from a lifelike tree in the corner of a restaurant. A lake in the country is a more artful version of a tiled pool in a mall. This perceptual change has led, in turn, to another, which has been called the new miniaturism. Things in the world now appear smaller, more toy-like. An object that once towered above us, a tall pine, a steep hill, a snow-capped mountain, is itself dwarfed by the dome, which, by the ever-present fact of its vastness, miniaturizes what it encloses. The Mississippi is nothing but a trickle of water in a child's terrarium. The Rockies are only a row of stones in a third-grade diorama. Events themselves, under such conditions, have receded in importance, have become aestheticized. Experience is beginning to feel like a collection of ingeniously constructed arcade games. It is because, living beneath the dome, people are reminded of playful words in enclosed and festive spaces, such as movie theaters, bowling alleys, laser tag arenas, video arcades, the old fun houses, and circuses. Indeed, one might argue that under the regime of the dome, the country has become not a mall, but an immense hall of entertainment, in which every citizen is a player. Certain unpleasant facts of life, run-down neighborhoods, traffic accidents, robberies, drive-by shootings, are in this view taken less seriously, since they are felt to be a part of the artificial displays under the dome. Death itself is losing its terror, has come to seem little more than a brilliantly contrived effect. There are rumors of grander plans. At a conference in Oslo, architects and engineers have proposed a transparent globe supported by massive Duracrist pillars, which would surround the entire Earth. That such a vision shall be fulfilled in our lifetime is unlikely. That it should have been dreamed at all is perhaps inevitable. For under the visible fact of the dome, it is difficult not to imagine still vaster encompassings. Already, at certain moments, in certain moods, the famous dome has come to seem a little diminished, a little disappointing. No doubt we shall never rest content until the great all is enclosed in a globe of transparent astralume. Then solar systems, galaxies, supernovas, infinite space itself will become elements of a final masterwork, a never-ending festival, a celestial amusement park, in which every exploding star and spinning electron is part of the Empyrean choreography. Meanwhile, we walk beneath the Celestilux sky, dreaming of new heavens, of impossible architectures, for a change is in the air. You can feel it coming.
That was Alec Baldwin reading Stephen Milhauser's story, The Dome. If you enjoy the Riley humorous stories on this broadcast, you might want to know about or even purchase our CD of funny tales entitled Lots of Laughs. Get all the details by going to selectedshorts.org. Friends, we'd like to take a few minutes on this broadcast to let you hear a small sampling of one of the most wonderful spin-offs that arise from Selected Shorts, our adult literacy program, which we call All Right. Let's listen now to stories read at the May 2008 All Right performance by Sonia Manzano and Cidia Cedeno. Magdalena Santiago of the New York City Department of Education School to United Bronx parents wrote this, The White Boots.
The day was beautiful, sunny, and hot. I woke up happy. I was 6 years old. My uncle came to spend the weekend with us. He was tall, strong, and in his late 30s. The house was small. I shared the only bedroom with my parents. My brothers and my uncle slept in the living room. A bigger house was under construction. That morning, I approached my uncle with a big smile on my face. He looked at me and he said, "If you help me close the couch, I will bring you a pair of white boots the next time I come to visit." Woo-hoo! A pair of white boots! I never had them before. Nobody uses boots here. The weather's hot. I used to walk in sandals or sometimes barefoot. I will be the envy of all my friends. Immediately, I put myself in action and help him to close the couch and push it to the corner where it belonged. The image of the white boots stayed on my mind. It was difficult for me to stop thinking about that wonderful gift and how the boots would look on my feet. During those days, I wanted to please my uncle and obey him. I went to the river with my uncle. We had a picnic. I splashed a lot of water. I never learned how to swim. The next day, he left our house. I hugged and kissed him and told him to come back soon with my white boots. The next passing days, I waited for him, thinking that he would come any moment. Every time the dog barked, I ran to the balcony of the house, thinking that it was my uncle with my white boots. But he never came back, and nobody knew about him anymore. Time passed. I graduated from high school, and 1 year later, I moved with my parents to New York City. Two of my brothers were already living in the city. We arrived at the end of February. It was cold. I felt uncomfortable wearing too many layers of clothing. The apartment was on the fifth floor without an elevator. Everything was strange for me. Tall buildings, wide streets, different people speaking strange languages. At night, when I went to sleep, I missed the sweet, harmonized sing of the coqui. One day I went to the shopping mall, and I saw a beautiful pair of white boots, just almost the same as those that I had imagined when I was a child. I went inside the store. I bought them. The boots were flat up to my ankle and with the fringe decorations. First time I put my boots, I felt wonderful. They looked beautiful on my feet. I looked in the mirror and it came to my mind, the white pair of boots my uncle once promised me.
From the New York City Department of Education School to United Bronx parents, A Handmade Sari by Begum Taj.
I grew up living with my grandmother in Bangladesh. We used to share a room in my uncle's house. She was not only my grandmother, but also my best friend. She was the most intelligent and kind woman that I had ever had in my life. She taught me how to achieve in life. I used to share all my dreams, ideas, and problems with her. At the age of 15, I started my first job at a local boutique store where I was designing clothes for the customers. When I got my first paycheck, I bought a silk sari for my grandmother. I designed the sari with beautiful handmade patterns. Every stitch had my love in it. It took me a whole month to finish the work. It was a Friday morning when my grandmother woke me up. She made me my favorite pancake for breakfast. Then she started cooking, cleaning, and doing other household chores. She was rushing to finish her work and then went to take a shower. I asked her, "Grandma, what happened? Why are you so hurried? Are you going somewhere?" She did not reply. I asked her again, "What happened to you? Are you feeling okay?" She replied after a deep sigh, "My father will come here and take me with him." I was puzzled. But grandmother, your father already passed away a long time ago." I thought she was joking with me, so I left for work. At 8 a.m., I dropped the sari in the laundry to iron it before going to work. When I finished my work, I ran to pick up the sari from the laundry. I was imagining how beautiful Grandma would be when she put on this new silk sari made by me. I was imagining how she would hold me in her arms and kiss me. With all these thoughts, I went home. At the door, I was excited, waiting for my grandmother to open the door for me. But I was surprised that my aunt opened the door. I saw a crowd of my relatives gathering in the living room. When I went to my grandmother's bedroom, I couldn't believe my eyes. The sari dropped from my hand. I stood there for a few minutes without knowing what to do. My grandmother was right. She went to heaven with her father. She was not joking about it. With tears, I wrapped the sari around her dead body. I wanted my grandma to know how much I loved her.
You've been listening to excerpts from the Selected Shorts Adult Literacy Program, All Right, read by Sonia Manzano and Cidia Cedeno. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.